Hey guys, hope everyone is well, man. I mean, what a week we've had. It's been an absolute madness, if you ask me. I still can't believe it, you know. From just another weekend in world football to an announcement that there's going to be an alliance of 12 clubs, up to 20 clubs even, taking part in the new European Super League. What the hell is going on, man? I mean, the announcement had everyone across Europe in football in an uproar. You know, it was almost became a civil war where you had chairmen, you know, stepping down and chief executives losing their jobs. You know, you had even Boris Johnson got involved at one point. And in the midst of all of that, you've even had Mourinho get sacked a couple of days before a Carabao Cup final. Honestly, it's a mad thing. I don't know what the hell was going on, but what I do know is that you lot should head over to Twitter and Instagram and let me know your thoughts. So that's at the Coaches Net on Twitter and at the Coaches Network on Instagram. But before we get to today's episode, guys, with a fascinating guest and it was a really enjoyable conversation, I want to take a moment just to read out one of our latest reviews and make a couple announcements for you guys. First of all, let me start with a review. It's a 5-star review that was left for us on Apple Podcast by Coach Leban. And Leban says, "It's been a great podcast. I started listening early on when there were only a fair few episodes. The topics are informative and the guests are highly knowledgeable and experienced in their fields." Leban, I just want to say thank you for that review. I really appreciate it, bro. But to the rest of you that have been following the podcast, I'm truly humbled and grateful for all your guys' support, man. Honestly, it's been a fascinating journey so far, and the feedback that I've been receiving, both via the social media, via the reviews, it's been really useful and motivating for me to keep this great content coming. Now, on that note, I want you guys to all pause this episode right now. Take 30 seconds of your time, head over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Let me know your thoughts on the podcast, whether it's a specific episode or whether it's just a show in general. Every single one of you that leaves a review, it honestly does wonders for helping me get up the charts on this podcast and gives an opportunity for people that haven't come across it to get access to it too. So please go ahead over and do that right now. Now, I mean, to think, having released on my first episode in May last year, and we're coming up to a year nearly, but you know, just going up to 11 months now, and today's going to be episode 103. It's a madness, you know, to think a year ago, if someone told me that I'll be having a podcast, let alone 103 damn episodes. Anyways, man, I just want to say thank you to everyone that's been involved, whether you've been a guest, whether you've been a listener, follower, silent follower, whoever you are. If you've been involved in some way, I want to say thank you, guys. It's been a massive support. But it does take a lot of work. It does take a lot of time and a lot of effort. Bear in mind, we're in the midst of a pandemic where it's been difficult for everyone. So, you know, it's your support that's kept me going. But on that note, a lot of people have been getting in touch, throwing me questions via the DMs and even messaging me saying, yes, you've been releasing all this content, but now I've only seen it once a week. So on that note, guys, I have decided to scale back a little bit. Doesn't mean you're going to get any less quality of the content. We still got some fascinating content coming out, fascinating guests and conversations taking place. But we do need your support to keep it going. So on that note, guys, you can now support the Coaches Network podcast with as little as a cup of coffee on Patreon, where you can get early access to some future content that's coming out, as well as some extended episodes and many other benefits to come. But head over to www.patreon.com/thecoachesnetwork to find out more about that. Your support will be truly appreciated. And a massive shout out to those guys who are already on Patreon. Big up to you guys. Finally, guys, before we get to today's episode, and I'm proud to announce also, we've recently launched our coach education program, and our new coach mentoring program will be starting next month in May. So on the eve of our first birthday, I'm pleased and proud to announce that we'll be launching the coach mentoring program for May 2021, where I'll be taking coaches through a 4-part system over the course of 4 weeks to help everyone involved get closer to achieving their coaching craft mastery. Finally, guys, don't forget to head over to our social media. Again, that's Twitter at the Coaches Net and Instagram at the Coaches Network to find out more information on that. Or you can get in touch by dropping me an email on info@thecoachesnetwork.co.uk. Finally, guys, I just want to thank you again for your time today. Now to today's episode. Hope you enjoy it. Let me know your thoughts. Leave me a review and let me know your key takeaways. Take care, guys.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach, coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Yes, good evening. Great to be with you all. First time on Clubhouse, so we'll see how it goes for me. I'm catching up slowly with all of the latest trends. My name is Tom Bates. I'm a UEFA coach, author of the book The Future Coach, and I guess you could say speaker as well. So my job is really predominantly within professional football. In Tokyo, I'll be traveling. In the summer, I'll be traveling to Tokyo, which is going to be the rescheduled Olympic Games 2021, to support the British Olympic swimming team. And other work that I do, I guess, extends out into education and executive leadership, really, for the corporate sector. So in sport, education and business, performance psychologist and UEFA licensed coach.
Awesome. Thank you for that introduction, Tom. So guys, you know, we're here this evening with Tom Bates to discuss the idea of peak performance, what it means, what it looks like and how we, you know, reach it. So Tom, I just want to start the conversation off right there, innit? You know, and I'm sure we're going to go into a lot of your experience. I'm sure you might have some interesting stories for us to kind of tap into and think about. But to start with, you know, what is peak performance to you? And, you know, and we'll kind of just tail off from there, really.
Oh, that's a great question, yes. You know, probably if you'd have asked me 15 years ago that question, I might have given you a completely different answer. To me, back then, was peak performance. I was looking at, you know, the very highest level of sport, the Premier League, the English Premier League, the Champions League, representing your country at the World Cup. You know, I would measure the standards of the highest possible level as the peak of performance. And, you know, to a degree, for the senior athletes, senior pros that I'm working with at the minute, that is the highest level, and they measure themselves against those standards set at that highest level. But I think as I've evolved, and I remember starting out my very first coaching job with the under nines all the way down to the AFC Bournemouth on the South Coast. It was amazing. Eddie Howe was my center of excellence manager, and I was privileged to work with a guy called Joe Roach, who now is still the head of youth down there at AFC Bournemouth. And Joe's a great guy, and he gave me my first opportunity in coaching. And, you know, it's funny. I remember thinking back now all those years ago to the under-9s team, you know, the players were just like, you know, little sponges, enthusiastic to learn and absorb all the teaching that they possibly could. And I remember thinking back now, so the answer I give you now is different to back then, right? Because the answer I give you now about peak performance is really unleashing your absolute optimum potential for who you are, not compared to anyone else, not compared to the standards of the Champions League or the World Cup or the Premier League. But peak performance to me, as I understand it, is to help others to unleash their full potential that they're truly capable of. And that's such a special privilege, because so many individuals, not just in sport and in professional football, but in education, in music, you know, television presenters that I work with, in business, we all of us have different journeys, and we all accelerate, you know, at different times for different reasons. We've got a different journey to unleash that full potential. So peak performance for me really is about the realization of that inner potential, that optimum potential that we each have. And we all have it. So it's about finding what it is for us and, you know, unleashing that as best we can.
I think that's a great, way to look at it. You know, to kind of start off then, you know, you talk about helping people reach their peak potential, whatever that might look like for them. Now, what are some of the things that you might want to start looking at as, I guess, indicators of peak performance? Because obviously, the perception of these things is obviously very different for each individual. What performance is in general, obviously, you know, if I ask that same question to someone else, the answer could be very different. So, you know, I guess from your perspective as a practitioner then, and having worked with people across different industries and not just within, you know, within football or just sports as a whole, are there any, consistent factors that people kind of look to identify as, identify, well, factors of key performance, peak performance even. And beyond that, is there any, you know, major differences that you see depending on the industries that you're, I guess, looking at within, if that makes sense as well?
Yeah, yeah, really good question. I mean, it's such a fascinating concept, isn't it? Because how we measure peak performance largely is fundamentally flawed. If we had the answers in professional football, right? Academies everywhere. Someone would, some academy director somewhere would have their feet, you know, up on the beach on a holiday, and they'd have cracked it. You know, how to spot potential and help potential to thrive. And some of that's about the environment, but a lot of that is about the inner qualities of the person, of the sports athlete. One of the stories that springs to mind just as I'm speaking to you now is I remember moving from the South Coast, coming to Birmingham City. And that was the first time I came into contact with a very young 16-year-old Nathan Redmond, now is, of course, in the Premier League at Southampton, represented England, etc. And back then, he was a young 16-year-old who I was just started to work with in the youth team. And I remember coming into the training ground at Wasp Hills at Birmingham one day, a little bit early, ready for a gym session. And the only person that was in was the cleaner. And I remember thinking how great it was to be in before the rest of the staff because I get the gym to myself. And then I opened the gym door at the training ground, and I remember seeing just this this little figure over there in the distance on the mat doing some, you know, serious amount of push-ups and, you know, dripping with sweat. And I thought to myself, wow, this is which player is this who's come in this early? And at that time, I didn't know Nathan because I was working with the under-18s. He was just only 16 at that time. And I remember thinking when I was speaking to Nathan, you know, what led to him coming in that early, doing extras? And as our relationship improved over the years, you know, he very quickly got spotted by the Youth England international setup and was invited for trials and represented the first team at Birmingham very quickly. And of course, went on to improve ever since. But I remember thinking, he told me a story about having to catch two buses to the training ground. He's from a single parent family. His mum, Michelle, is an incredible driving force in his life. He comes from humble beginnings. He wasn't, you know, financially wealthy at all. But when I was speaking to him that morning in the gym that day, I remember thinking to myself that there is within this person a spark inside of them. There is an inner drive, a quality that is unshakable in terms of the effort that he's willing to put in, especially when no one's watching. And it sounds a little bit cliche, but no one was watching that day, you know? There was no one that was going to find out that he was in early. No one was standing over him to make sure that he did it. He wasn't recovering from an injury. There was just a spark that grew into a flame. So when you're asking me about the early signs of what, how to spot peak performance, the thing that I would say, and probably this is cross-contextual, right, is that there must be an inner desire. A lot of popular psychologists, you know, they'll talk about how a little bit of their job is to motivate other people, you know, and how to get the best out of someone is that you have to motivate them. And, you know, yes, I'm not so sure that it's possible to really motivate anyone. I mean, I say that because, and that sounds quite controversial. What do you mean it's not possible to motivate anyone? Like, surely, you know, we listen to music and you watch inspirational videos and we, you know, yes, all of that absolutely can be an inspiration. But before that, there has to be something inside the person. You know, you can't have a fire without spark. There has to be something within. And, you know, you hear managers talking about this idea that you can't give that to someone. And that doesn't mean to say that we can't inspire as coaches. We can't light the path, if you like, ahead. But we can't take the steps for them. We can't take steps for another. So that inequality of intention, of drive, of wanting to be something more, you know, that inner feeling that there is more to give, that must come from within.
100%. I think you make some good points. And, you know, a couple of things just kind of re-spring out for me around what you said is, first of all, you were very, I guess, descriptive about his maybe his upbringing and his environmental factors. And also, I'm curious to know, maybe through having conversations with him, maybe as an individual, or maybe some research that you've potentially come across in the past, whether there's actually any links to having an upbringing like that or similar to that, that has a correlation with people who tend to be higher or more outstanding performers, if you like. I mean, I've got a couple others, but we'll start with that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm not sure about the literature and what it suggests, but from my personal experience working within, you know, the industry, multiple football clubs, academy, youth international, senior domestic, all the way through to senior international, that is something that appears again and again. Out of the 1.5 million grassroots players that start, you know, No Hunger in Paradise, the research by Colin suggests that, you know, out of 1.5 million that start, a percentage of 0.012 make it out of 1.5 million that start grassroots. And, you know, I have to say that one of the great problems that's systemic or endemic of modern day football academy is that everything is taken care of for the players developing through the academies. Pretty much everything. You know, they have nutritional advice, they have psychologists, they have strength and conditioning coaches, they have transportation, they have accommodation sorted for them, they've got minibus drivers that pick them up and take them everywhere. You know, literally everything's taken care of. So, you know, if it's the reverse of creating an independent thinking athlete, an athlete that's able to self-regulate, self-manage, manage not just their professional careers, but also their lives. And so in many ways, with the best of intentions, academies are, you know, I'm not judging them. I was part of that system for some years. But in many ways, the academy, with the best intentions, is harming, not helping. Mm. They're reducing the levels of inner hunger, inner desire. You know, if I'm earning a substantial amount of money by the time I'm 15, 16 in a competitive market, then, you know, I could feel like I've made it before I've made it. And senior pros talk about young ones coming through the system and walking around like they've already had 50 appearances before they've even done anything. And that can be a really rude awakening for some of the young players coming through, you know. So I think something that is very important to help keep feet on the ground, so to speak, is learning the value of the things that we're surrounded by. I mean, there's all sorts of influences. We can take this conversation wherever you want to go, really, but social media is a big influence. You know, everybody wants to post the five-star lifestyle and not necessarily represent the challenge or the struggle, which is the real, you know, there simply isn't any great success without significant struggle and challenge. And it is tough. It's hard.
No, I think you make some great points. Obviously, that, you know, really what you're referring to is obviously the modern day player and how much has changed in that respect. So I guess, and this probably, you know, probably ties in with your book a little bit in terms of the future coach. What does the modern day coach need to look like to kind of manage some of these factors? And, you know, as you're talking there, I'm thinking, right, is Tom just telling me really what you know, in short, in brief, that actually today's performers aren't as effective as performers as they once were or potentially once could have been, because so much is being done for them, essentially, which, you know, I totally understand the logic behind that. So I guess, you know, coming back to a previous point you mentioned about, you know, trying to motivate someone, this is where the question came from initially, because obviously if for someone like Nathan, as you touched on there, maybe coming from a background like that would maybe feel like there's some lack potentially of something in his life, and you know, almost that hunger and that drive comes from having that lack, if you like. What would be, you know, I guess, how does that then differ? And, you know, you said there is many examples of people coming from similar backgrounds and similar upbringings, but you also get people on the flip side of that. You know, what are some of the key, I guess, factors and differences maybe when you're looking at those people and how they're able to manage their performances and reach a peak performance, if you like?
Yeah. Yes, great question. For me, you know, having, you know, I know Nathan personally and worked with him for several years, and I think the meaning and purpose, Nathan saw a light, a reward at the end of that hard work, and the reward was to help his family to live a better life.
Mm.
And so it wasn't really about him, actually. It was about helping his mum and his brothers and sisters to have something that they didn't have at that time, right? To repay them, in a sense, for their love and support, for taking them to training, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 days a week, sometimes traveling all around the country to support him. And at that time, it really wasn't about success either. It was like, you know, win, lose or draw, we love you anyway. There was an unconditional love that was given from his mum. And of course, he saw the light of making it as a professional to give back to his mum and dad, brothers and sisters. So I think for those that come from more privileged backgrounds, I was speaking with, I'm up to Leeds United tomorrow, and one of the players at Leeds were talking about Patrick Bamford. You know, there's significant wealth in the family. JCB comes from a very well-educated background. And so that doesn't necessarily mean to say that people who come from a better financial background aren't necessarily as hungry. But I think the point here is about a strong enough purpose, a reason for doing what you do. And when you dig deep behind the reason that, you know, that someone will give you, any high achiever that they give you for going out and that drive that is demonstrated, what they do consistently every single day, no matter what, no matter whether they're successful, whether they fail, there is that relentless drive. I think you find a very strong purpose behind it all.
No, definitely. I think it's two kind of key things I want to kind of bring out there. I hope you can touch on them before I forget them, really. But the first one is obviously looking at the financial element. You know, there's been a bit of a discussion in the press recently regarding Patrick Bamford, and you know, I guess his comments made by Sean Dyche as an example, around his upbringing, and you know he's coming from a privileged background, if you say. That's the first aspect. The second bit I want to kind of touch on is that. This is just, it might be, you might have an answer for this, you might not, but that reason, essentially what you're saying is you're understanding the why, really, correct me if I'm wrong, why you do what you're doing and the importance of that why. I'm curious to know, is it possible to generate a why for something that you don't have a passion for?
That's a really great question. Goodness me. Is it? So can you find a reason? So you're not genuinely, you're not authentically. Is that what you mean?
Essentially. So as an example, you know, you've got footballers that come out now. Some of them say they don't actually enjoy playing the game. But obviously they've got a talent. They've got an ability to kind of perform at a certain level and they make a living out of it. But it's not necessarily their passion. Now, it's maybe not the best example, but let's say outside of the sporting world or outside of football specifically, is it possible to see an avenue that can be lucrative and worthwhile or in some ways, but it's not a passion, and be able to find a why for that?
Yeah, I see what you mean. So it's a really good... Now, I definitely... what you're saying is so true, because I've met and have worked with at different times in my career senior professionals who have fallen out of love with the game, or they don't really love the game at all. And you know, if you ask them, what do you do after you go home and watch Match of the Day? Do you watch the highlights on Sky? Do you watch your games back? They'll say, absolutely not. I don't go anywhere near football at all after I've played or trained. And you know, it's not actually surprisingly, there are more than we think. There are more than we think, and I think it's partly due to the image and of football on the screen. You know, everybody sees the stage performance. Nobody sees what goes on behind the scenes. And that is not as pretty as the shining lights of Sky Sports, right? But I think what happens is, even for those players, their why is strong enough because they see it as an occupational way to support their family, or to create investments in other businesses, for example. That's getting even more now popular in the modern day situation, especially when players earn so much money per week, you know. So they are aware that they don't love what they do necessarily as much as they used to, or perhaps they never did, but they're extremely good at it. Is it possible to generate a strong enough why? Absolutely, because it's a clinical why. I know that if I perform at a level, then this outcome, financial outcome, is going to support other investments that I have, and those investments are going to return a profit. So I'm still motivated. Or, you know, I know if I play very well or score this many goals, then goal bonuses are going to mean X. And that means that I'll be able to pay off mum and dad's house at the end of it, for example. So it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be a why because you love it. And that's from my experiences. I would have to say yes, though, you know, that if you, if it, this is a contentious one, isn't it? But for those players that really love it, I would say when it gets particularly difficult, you know, hard, dark mornings, you know, wet, cold, drizzly days, times when the alarm goes off at 6 a.m. or whatever it is, and you've got, you know, you've got a treble session or whatever, and you're going, I really could just deal with a day off now. I've just played two games in a week and my legs are about to fall off. I think players that genuinely love it or are in love with performing at their very highest level, mentally, emotionally, technically, tactically, physically, spiritually, you know, there's something that happens that transcends this transactional idea, you know, beyond. So I don't think you have to love it. It's possible to make it and not love it. But I think if you love it, or love the journey, if you like, then performance can reach a new level.
Awesome, nice, some great points there. Guys, just want to quickly refresh the room for everyone. You're tuning into a live edition of the Coaches Network podcast. I'm here with Tom Bates, UEFA A licensed coach, performance psychologist, speaker, and author of the book, The Future Coach. Tom's taken out his time this evening to talk to us about reaching peak performance, what that looks like, what it means, if we can even establish a definition for it. But, you know, Tom, it's kind of break back into your last point there. You know, you talked there about it is possible to generate that why if the profit off the back of it, or the gain, can be, you know, attached to an investment or something else that means something to the person essentially. Now with that naturally comes pressure. So I guess from that perspective, you know, first of all, again, you know, I'm really keen to get your perspective and your definition of what you define pressure to be. And then how maybe you've seen that impact people in different ways, and maybe start to explore a little bit further around, is there ways that we can kind of, if you like, prepare to deal with pressure, and look at it from a maybe pre, during, and after phase, if that makes sense. And I don't know if there's a strategy or a way in which you can look at it, but it'd be very interesting to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, really good. First of all, one of my favorite authors, he's passed on now, but speakers, Dr. Wayne Dyer, he had this wonderful phrase that I was listening to on YouTube one day, and it struck me, you know, something that I've always remembered, and I keep coming back to it, and I share it with, you know, everybody I speak with, if I can remember. he's talking about, he says, there is no pressure, there is no anxiety in the world. There is no stress out there in the world. There are only people, and you could say players, teams, coaches, managers, thinking anxiously, thinking stressful thoughts. So this, that's an insight into, why I love that is because it's an insight into the nature of emotion, isn't it? And when we think about pressure, we tend to think about how the media frames it to us. It's a cup final, or these 3 points mean that we make the playoffs, or if we don't win, then we are going to go down and get relegated, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And a large amount of that is an inner process. It's not an external reality. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is how we perceive, how we see the world, okay, whether it's accurate or not, becomes our reality, becomes true for us. In a sense, we create our own realities, right? Because the way that we think affects the way we feel. The way that we feel defines our behaviors in a sporting context, defines our performances. But it all starts with thought, with a cognition. That said, yes, for the highest performers that I've ever worked with, they perceive pressure as a privilege.
Mm.
It's a great thing to have for them. In fact, they need it. They actively seek it out to be able to thrive. And when you speak to them, they will tell you, unless there's a bit of pressure, then there's no way I can be at my best. I need that. You know, I want the fans to be in the stadiums. I want all eyes on me. I need this to mean something. You know, one of my mentors, Bill Beswick, told me a great story about Roy Keane. They'd just won the Premiership title away at Southampton. They were flying back for Manchester United. Bill was sat next to Sir Alex Ferguson. Roy Keane comes down the plane and he says to Sir Alex, boss, I can't play on Saturday. This is just after Manchester United have won the league. And Sir Alex Ferguson says, what do you mean, Roy? We need you to play Saturday. Roy says, no, I'm not playing Saturday. I don't play friendlies. Great insight. I mean, he's a warrior, right? It's a different mindset completely. He's very unique in lots of different ways. But essentially, there is something about the makeup of a high performer that needs that pressure, that seeks that pressure out. Not only that, but they see it and perceive it as a real privilege, something that gets them going. It's an exciting place to be, right? And you can think about this if we were going to give a presentation at work, the more people, the better, or there's a certain number, you know, there's a lot of money riding on this presentation or this pitch or whatever, or I'm just about to meet the CEO of whatever company that I'm about to pitch to. You know, that's exciting, right? This is a sign that if I feel a little bit of pressure, I'm getting ready to go. It's a great thing, right? On the flip side of that, having said all of that, pressure can sometimes unhinge athletes and it can, harm performance, largely because we think about some kind of negative consequence to failure. So a fear of failure can certainly come in, and I can be afraid of the negative consequence, or I can be afraid of success. Good stuff like this doesn't normally happen to someone like me. This is too good to be true, right? There's a bit of pressure here. And oftentimes we come back to this idea of the way we see and perceive it is really the key. If it's something that I think is going to help me, then it will. You know, it's this idea of the placebo effect. A pill with no pharmacology whatsoever can have the same, you know, molecular effects, the same physiological responses, hormonal responses in the body physiologically, as the actual medicine itself. Now, why is that? That's a great question to ask. It can only mean that the mind has a significant power. The power of the mind. I think, yes, we're only just beginning to scratch the surface, really, of the power of the mind. Science is starting to catch up and, you know, with the developments being able to prove this, but really, the power of the mind is the greatest. If we can harness the power of the mind, you know, the mind really is the athlete. The body's simply the means to jump higher, run faster, be quicker. The mind really is the athlete.
No, I love that. And I think, you know, you talked there really about, you know, the pressure element and how some people basically can thrive with it and some people essentially crumble with it. I'm conscious to know, maybe from a practitioner perspective, as a coach, how wide is that spectrum? How many notches should there be on that dial? How soon and how, or how long should we wait before we maybe dial it up and dial it down? And is there any ideas around whether that should be dialed up earlier in the week, later in the week, depending on, game day minus one, game day minus four, and so on and so forth? Very interested to kind of pick your brains on that and, you know, maybe take it from there.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, because I was walking just the weekend in the hills with a friend of mine called Jason Fox. He's ex-SBS, SAS. He's the show on Channel 4, SAS, Who Dares Wins. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Civilians and celebrities that go into camp and they train, they're essentially exposed to all of the pressures that the SAS recruits would face when they're trying to make it. Okay. and special selection for the forces. And I was saying to him, you know, how did you, and you know, this, yes, this is out of sport context now. This is like military life at the highest level in the military. You know, I was asking him about times when he would be hanging out at the back of a helicopter and he was just about to be deployed on a mission and, you know, bullets would be flying up at the helicopter and he's down this zip wire and the helicopter's not landing. And he knows that as soon as he lands, he's going to be bombarded. So this is not like if I make a mistake, we lose the game. Mm. If I make a mistake, I get subbed off. Or if I make a mistake, you know, this is life and death. I can't imagine a more pressurized situation. And I was fascinated to, you know, how do you get to train your mind to thrive, perform optimally under that amount of pressure when you know the single slightest mistake can be life and death, not just for you, but all of your squadron, you know? And he said to me, well, to be honest, the greatest advantage that we had within the military is that down at Limestone, the Royal Marines headquarters, is that 95% of our time was spent training in conditions that were unimaginable. Mm. We trained for every single eventuality, upside down, strapped into helicopters, in a blacked out swimming pool, you know, bombarded. Just, he went into all of the different scenarios. And he said to me, to a degree, when I got to that mission, I went into autopilot. So I had already trained my mind to deal and respond to all the unpredictable scenarios that could happen. I'd envisaged responding in the right way, overcoming challenges. He said his mind simply was able to perform under pressure because of the training that they underwent.
Just a question on that then. Because of the training now, the mind was able to deal with the pressure. So I guess, you know, what sparked in my head is, right, so how much variability should there then be within the training session? One. The second one is obviously, you touched on that, they trained for essentially every eventuality. Now, I guess if I took it away from that element and moved it back into sport, for instance, we're looking at, I guess, really that random variable situation. How many different potential outcomes could there be? But then obviously in response to a situation like that with the SAS training and whatnot, there's probably only certain limited responses or limited outcomes you can probably predict. My naivety tells me. Whereas maybe in a sport context, it's probably again, still, it can still be random. It's still an element of limited predictability, but there's probably, again, feel free to kind of contradict me or go against me if you like, but I would say there's still an element of more certainty around the outcomes that could occur, if that makes sense.
In sport.
Opposed to that of, you know, what an SAS soldier or might be training for, or the conditions they might train under, because of, you know, the severity of the situation, if you like. So I guess from that perspective,
you
then,
think so?
Pardon?
Yeah, you think so? I was the same as you before I got to you know, speak to him and ask the questions. I was exactly the same as you. I thought to myself, you know, surely there's only a set number of things that could possibly take place. But, you know, Foxy told me stories about they'd have these plans, they'd get up in the helicopter, and right at the last minute, they'd receive a piece of intelligence that would say, you need to change, you need to tear up everything that you've prepared.
No, but that's exactly what I'm touching on. So in a sport context, we're probably not going to get that as often. And if there is something that comes out, it's, again, feel free to kind of go against me, but I feel there's only a certain amount of outcomes that we can probably predict or that will occur that we haven't seen or been able to prepare for. Whereas in a situation like that, I don't know, anything could occur, really. Literally anything could occur, especially because it's out in an open environment where, you know, you can't control what's happening in the air, if you like. So I think that, you know, that variability and that unpredictability around that is probably going to naturally bring more pressure to the situation. But, you know, it is interesting. I was listening to a conversation this morning, and the idea of
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Just kind of letting things be. It's, you know, it just brought me around to this concept of, you know, back in, you know, the cliche saying of, you know, control the controllables and just focus on what you can actually control. Forget about everything else. Everything else is going to happen anyway, whether you want it to happen or not. So I guess from that perspective, it makes me think, right, what is pressure then? pressure is what you create yourself. And it comes back to the, you know, the saying that you mentioned earlier. I can't remember who the gentleman was now, but, you know, people,
Wayne Dyer.
So, you know, people just think stressfully rather than it actually being stressed, if that makes sense. And I guess if you come back to the concept of the placebo effect, they're naturally, you know, they're almost having a placebo effect in that manner as well. They're generating that stress rather than actually, it's almost, there's no stress, but because they're thinking about the stress, they're generating stress. Now they are stressed, if you like. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's quite fascinating how the mind works in that way. So I guess, you know, from that perspective, kind of linking it back to the sport context, and as a coach, I'm now thinking, right, how do I now find the right level of pressure where it's, I'm pushing you out of your comfort zone, but you're kind of on the, you know, you're not too far over the other end of it where, you know, any given point now you could just tip off and crumble. But actually you're on that point there. And it kind of, I want to use that word that you touched on earlier about, you do feel like you can manage independently. But you're almost, you've got your toe half in, toe half out, if you like.
So many things I could do. We could do this for 3 hours, I'm sure, easily. I love talking about this. You know, I knew it was going to be a great time together. The so that concept of the independent athlete, right? And let's get back to the independent athlete and dialing up pressure. First of all, I think as coaches, we have to see the world through the eyes of our players. We have to know the personality. We have to know the person.
Mm.
Behind the player, and we have to be so curious and explore who they really are. What gets the very best from them? Because it's going to be different for every player, right? What works for one is not going to work for all. It's not one size fits all. It's understanding the individual, because when you understand the person, the individual, both the person and the performer self, you get to understand what they need. Now, what they need might not be the arm around the shoulder. What they need, there's a great story. A friend of mine, Lee Carsley, was at Tottenham Hotspurs one day taking a coaching session, and John Mack, the then academy director, walked with Lee, and there was a centre forward doing shooting practice, and they watched from afar, right? And he repeated these shots into the top corner near enough every single time. And John says to Lee, listen, we're going to go over, we're going to watch, and I'm going to start to shout things to him and see how it affects his performance. Classic, right? Simple experiment. They walked over in behavioral psychology, walked over, and sure enough, as they stood there watching, John started to shout things to him like, you know, more in the corner, or keep it down, a little bit lower. He started to miss the target completely.
Mm.
Now, this is the point at which we're talking about, you know, how much is too much on the dial, okay? Sometimes the trauma, talent needs trauma. It's a great phrase. So the intervention can be to dial the pressure up just to the point where there's that stretch. It's just outside the comfort zone of what I'm currently capable and confident in doing, right? Not so much that you're going to break me. So he didn't bring the player over and humiliate him in front of all of the coaches. They walked away together afterwards. And the coach became an, I don't want to say the word expert, but finely tuned in observing the behavioral response to that situation. Enough to know that I might come back next week and do the same thing and see how you get on then. And then I might bring a friend. Or we might record you, actually, and then show it to you afterwards. Some kind of stimulus.
Mm.
to intervene, perhaps to distract, you know?
So, no,
I can see a thing.
Yeah, no, it's just, I'm just thinking a couple of different things are popping in my head there. First of all, I totally understand the concept. And I think it is, you know, I guess a very basic example, but a good one nonetheless. So I guess the question is, I personally, you know, like yourself, I've maybe shifted in my way, in the way I work and how I perceive coaching and what I perceive coaching to be and the impact I potentially want to have on my players over the years. To the point where I was very directive before. I used to be quite heavy on, I want it to look like this. I'm telling them what to do. So it was fully dependent rather than independent. But then also I'm not fully satisfied by the idea of players being independent either. I believe there should be, you know, that almost that branch in between, that level in between of interdependence. And if I'm looking at it holistically, you know, I guess if we use the four corner model as an example, yes, technically, tactically, I want you to be fully proficient. I want you to be fully aware of how to maybe use a number of tools from a technical toolbox and apply them in a tactical context. And that could be independent, potentially, but I don't want it to be dependent more than anything else. But as much as you're fully, I guess, equipped and capable and competent on that side of things, I also want you to be very socially and psychologically aware. So are you actually aware of why you're picking the decisions that you're picking? Are you aware of the factors that are affecting your decision making, or what you're actually considering in that moment? So again, becoming more aware and self-aware, not just on how the environment and the people around you are impacting you, but how maybe, and you use the word, they're attuned. So for instance, if a player is going through a technique of a shot or whatever it may be, I've kind of gone down this path where I wanted to become interdependent and I wanted to really become skilled or attuned, if you like, as you said, to your feelings, your thoughts, your emotions as you're going through the action. So as an example, if you take a shot and it doesn't work out, are you able to pinpoint at some way through that process why it didn't work out for you? And I'm really kind of passionate about it, to the point where, you know, people often ask, you know, this question's always, what kind of coach are you? You know, what's your philosophy and this and that? And, you know, from a playing perspective, I don't really have a philosophy. I'm not really bothered about that, because ultimately my experience tells me that if you follow the principles of play, however they need to be applied in a given context, whether that be, you know, going long, going short, building up, whatever that might be, at the end of the day, they're there for a reason, and they're there to achieve one thing, and that's the outcome of trying to score a goal and eventually win the game. And there's no coach or no player or no one in this world that can tell me otherwise, because if Pep Guardiola, we've seen it at Man City, we've seen it, whichever coach, they've got a style of play, but if it's on to go long, they're going long. And that's the realities of it. And on the flip side of that, you've got Louis van Gaal and his time at Man United, where that just wasn't a priority. It was just maintaining possession rather than having a purpose behind it. So without going too far off track, but it's about, for me, identifying the why. So I often maybe speak to players and I really try and understand the why. So if other coaches ask me what my philosophy is, well, I see myself as a coach of the why and not necessarily the what or the how. I'm not really bothered how they achieve an outcome. Yes, there might be things that we could do as coaches to kind of refine it, polish it up and maybe tweak it a little bit, but I'm more interested in getting them to understand why they've selected that technique in the way they have. What have they paid attention to in that moment? Have they chosen a decision because a player is maybe 5 yards away as opposed to being 7 yards away? Have they chosen it because of maybe in that moment they had a certain feeling, or there was a different comfortability about this position of their body that they were more in tuned with, that meant this was the right moment to play the pass or receive it in a particular way, if that makes sense. So I guess from that perspective, you said it's really important for the coach to obviously see it from the player's perspective. What kind of conversations then, you know, in a roundabout way I've gone there, but what kind of conversations are you then expecting the coaches to potentially have with these players and really try and understand their perspectives? You know, the most simple and probably basic one is that we get taught and we kind of learn is, well, go and stand in a position where you can see what the players can see. Yeah, that's great. I can probably see the angle, but reality is I'm never actually going to see what they can see unless I find out what they're actually paying attention to. So off the back of that, you know, my question to you is, what are the types of conversations we're having? Should conversations even be had, or do we use a different means to kind of assess and interact with that element?
Yeah. Oh, Matt, you know, there's so much great stuff in there. Yes. I'm taking notes as well, by the way. Never mind. Never mind me giving the advice. I would say it takes as much skill to ask the right questions, you know, in the right way, at the right time, with the right personality, as it does to know all the answers. And for far too long, coaching has traditionally, in England anyway, traditionally relied on this autocratic method of, I'm going to tell you and you're going to do it. And if you question me, then you're on the bench or you're not going to play because I'm in charge. And there's this fundamentally flawed, you know, almost tribal sort of the gaffer in football. So what he says goes. And no one's allowed to challenge that. You can't have a discussion about that. So players get really good at understanding that, you know, if I do what the coach says, then that means the reward of that means I'm going to play. So why would I ever jeopardize my position in the team by disagreeing or, you know, trying to say? And then the other thing that happens, not only as coaches do we want to tell our players what to do, if they disagree with us or if we ask them, you know, how did you see that situation? And they tell me, the worst mistake I can make as a coach is to say, well, actually, you know, you're wrong, because this is actually what happened. Because all the player thinks is, I've just shared with you exactly how I saw the situation. You're disagreeing. You weren't in the situation. You couldn't see what I saw. You couldn't feel what I felt.
No, and I think you make a great point there, Tommy. And it really kind of brings me to an experience I've had with many times with a player. And I probably was that coach. And if you know, you're wrong. That's not what happened. But actually, I don't know what happened until I find out from their perspective what happened. I can see objectively and, wow, this is what I believe to have happened. But that's for me. You know, I like to use the phrase sometimes, you know, you can't see the picture if you're within the frame. So, you know, for me being on the side, and I can actually have a look and see, right, actually, this is what I think. And like I said, as much as we can kind of pick up a position that allows us to see what they potentially have a view or an eye view of, I'm never going to understand it, because it's not just what they see and it's how it's, again, and these are why it's really important to me to kind of understand and or even help the players even understand, because often they don't maybe have the answers to these questions unless they ask them, how did you feel in that moment? What did you pay attention to? How did it impact you? How did you, you know, not just feel physically but emotionally? And also I kind of utilize it in my practice design a little bit, where I might think, right, as an example, we've got a practice. So I play the ball to you. You're 5 yards away. I probably wouldn't do it like this, but just giving a basic example. I have a player that's 2 yards behind you. That player is always going to be behind you. But depending on how many yards he's behind you, I want to kind of almost gauge, if you like, at what point does the pressure get cranked up too much for you? And it's not a case that the player could be just a static player. But at what point does his, I guess, his position in the space that you're in affect you? Mm-hmm. Is it when he's a yard away from you? Is it when he's 5 yards away from you? Now, the more I can start to, I guess, bring your awareness and your attention to those things, hopefully the better we can, or the better we can kind of work together in terms of, if you like, finding a solution to overcome that sort of challenge. Or understand closely, right, actually, when you're the one playing in that position, as an example, it could be playing up top with his back to goal. When you're playing up back to goal, the best time for us to feed you in is when the guy's 2 yards away, not when he's right up your back. And actually then utilize that sort of information to kind of work with the strategy of the team and however else you wish to view it. So I'm really interested to know maybe what your thoughts are on an approach like that, firstly. And secondly, if you've got any examples of where you've maybe had some of these sorts of conversations with players and what the general kind of response has been, because largely, like you said, the approach is very autocratic. And obviously coach education has changed massively to the point where it is now about having a holistic approach. So I guess the second question is, have you maybe come across someone who's maybe describing their philosophy or their way of working in a similar way that I am now?
Yeah, first of all, I love what you're saying. To see the world through the eyes of players, to ask them questions. What did you see? What were you aware of? What did you think? These are questions that really should be in certainly in the modern day world, in a coach's toolkit, fundamental questions. Then the other part of that is, you mentioned earlier this concept of interdependency. So we move from a phase of just understanding the individual to sharing that understanding in and amongst this living, breathing organism that is the team. And we bring that to discussion. We share those conversations. We share the learning. We share the insights. When you do that, the outcome is better understanding of self and each other. So that I know where and when you want the ball, how you want the ball, why you want the ball, where and when you want the ball, because we've talked about it. We've aligned ourselves in the same vision, this connected, this unified understanding of each other. And I call it a living, breathing organism because it changes, it evolves, it adapts, it moves so fast, and it's not rigid. One of the biggest things about coaching in England is that we've been for far too long one-dimensional. And we put practices on with a cone there and a cone there, and the ball goes forwards and backwards, and that's it. We repeat it, and that's our passing drill, you know? I'm not saying that a closed skill like that doesn't have value and benefit, but in of and by itself certainly isn't optimal. And when it's repeated too often in the absence of interference, you really only get one outcome, which is the ability to do it in that closed environment. As soon as you add interference or opposition or defenders, it becomes difficult. So in many ways, you know, I'm a big fan of simple practices with interference, allowing the coach to observe how much is too much, allowing the player to experience the interference and actually feel how much is too much, see what they perhaps didn't see before. You know, if I can do it against 1v1 scenarios, can I do it 1v2? Can I do it 1v3 with a support player in my favor who plays behind the lines? You know, and we add interference, we build it. It's an ongoing, systematic dial, as you described earlier. You know, as coaches, if we can really get good at understanding that it isn't just so one-dimensional, we can increase or decrease at any time.
No, I think you make a good point there.
Better chance of developing better players.
And no, it's definitely a great point. It kind of brings me around one of the key things I say. I don't believe in unopposed practice. It's not to say that it doesn't have some benefits, and I'm not saying that at all. But I definitely don't see how it can be the most, and I guess it's the most efficient way of working, if efficient at all. So for me, if I was reduced to having to do an unopposed practice, for me, it's still important to kind of add that context in this. As an example, we could be 1v1 unopposed and just doing that 5-yard passing drill, as you put it. Now, if I just throw in a spanner in the works and say, right, Tom, I want you to play the pass to me as if there's someone on your right hand shoulder and he's 2 yards away. So whenever you receive it back, just imagine there's a player 2 yards away on your right hand shoulder. You now have to change the way you play. And if you don't, then you probably don't understand the context enough. And I often, last couple of years I've been working in coach education, and it almost grates on me at times when people are dedicated to doing unopposed practices. I just don't understand it. But each to their own, I guess. And but I'm conscious of obviously time, and I really wanted to kind of talk about this element here before we kind of bring some of the listeners potentially into the conversation as well. I mean, just on that note, guys, you are tuned into the live edition of the Coaches Network podcast. I'm here with my guest, Tom Bates. Tom is a UEFA licensed coach, performance psychologist, speaker, and author of the book, The Future Coach. We're talking about, how to reach your peak performance, what it means. And we're going to soon be talking about applying some peak performance principles, but there will be an opportunity for you guys to get in with some questions. Please join in the conversation. Raise your hands when the time is right, and use the hashtag on Twitter, the Coaches Network podcast, to let people know your thoughts on the discussion, and potentially to invite other people into the conversation. What you can also do while you're there, guys, if you hit my profile picture, Tom's profile picture, hit that follow button and the bell next to it so you can be alerted when this future conversation is taking place. But back over to you, Tom, talking about those peak performance principles, what are they and how do they work?
We know that we did it on 3 hours. I think the first one is self-awareness. If each of, if we're talking to all the listeners now, any guys out there, whether you're a coach, whether you're an athlete or not, you know, we talked about what peak performance is, and that is unleashing our inner potential. What is that inner potential? Well, first of all, we have to really get good at asking ourselves, what do I really want? What do I really want? What is it? And why do I want it? Why do I want it? You know, most of us never really ask those deeper questions, the inner work that it takes. You know, I'm not talking about the action that we take. The action comes later. This is, if you like, the seeds, the roots of the tree starts with us, self-understanding. You know, there's a maxim that's inscribed at the temple of Apollo in Greece, Delphi. Know thyself. Know thyself. Self-awareness, knowing ourselves, understanding ourselves, is the fundamental prerequisite for achieving our peak potential, peak performance, you could say. Start with self, always seek to understand self, spend time. One of the things we don't do, especially because of the pace of the modern day world, with the pandemic perhaps, it's, you know, we've been forced, there's a forced stillness, if you like, to eject from the busyness of the world, to quieten ourselves down a little bit and become more familiar with asking these questions of ourselves, you know? What is it that I really want? What is my, you know, for, I don't want to get so deep with this right now for anyone tuning in, but, you know, when we talk about purpose, what is yours? You know, what meaning do you want to have? What, how do you want to make the world a better place? If you ask me why I coach, why do I coach? I coach to help improve people. That's my basic answer. It's a service to the people that I work with. Yes, they're high performers, and yes, they, some of them are celebrities and they perform at the very highest level. But if I'm coaching a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old or whoever it is that I'm with, I, for me, there is not a greater joy in the world than to help that person to be a better version of themselves. So I know that because I've spent time thinking about why I do what I do, what my purpose is, you know? So if we can get curious enough to ask ourselves those questions, then I think we become more aware of what it is that we want, why we want it, and what we need to do to go about achieving it. Those three questions can be powerful for anyone, wherever you are, whatever you do.
I think, you know, some great points. And like I say, it's really about that self-awareness piece. And I think, you know, these are kind of, the, I guess, in some ways, on a more micro scale, some of the questions I do kind of lend to my players, if you like. But, you know, I'm conscious of time. I want to kind of get give the listeners an opportunity to jump in here as well. So, guys, if you have a question for Tom, feel free to raise your hands, come to the stage, ask a question. If you've got one, of course, don't feel pressured. I don't think anyone's got any questions for you. I think you've just kind of blown them away, Tom. we've got a couple here. Let's see what we've got.
My wife says I talk too much. Can you believe it, Yes?
No, I can't, man. I get the same, so I know the feeling. Right. Up to the stage. So we've got Jacques and we've got Kat. So Jacques, welcome to the stage. Just introduce yourself and let us know what your question is, and we'll go from there.
Hi, I'm a very, I've got a video with you as well, so I'm both on stage. Excuse me. Tom, yes, thanks for having me on. Great conversation, great insight. Only question I had really was, what's been your experiences of best practice so far? Is there one that really sticks out to you both? That's close to nailing what you believe in, Tom, in any effective environment we've seen by the SAS.
Did you hear that all right, Tom?
Best practice?
Yeah.
One that stands out for me? Yeah. Jack, that's an amazing question, because there are two immediately that jump to spring to mind when I'm thinking about it. And they're not actually technical, tactical practices. So I'm going to try to tell this story as quickly as possible. 2011, I was very privileged to be invited to travel to FC Barcelona and spend a few days watching the first team and being, you know, chaperoned around the place and learning about the philosophy and culture, etc. And I remember one day in particular, I was watching. The first team were about to play Arsenal in the Champions League semi-final. Van Persie got the second yellow in that game. I remember that. But on that day, I was in at the training ground and I was watching the youth team prepare to play, I think it was the under-12s. And they were against another Spanish team. But I remember watching as the players themselves, the whole team, before the game, carried every single player in the under-12s Barcelona team, went to the goal to set up the goal. They carried the goal as a team physically, both goals to either end. Then they got the four corner flags, and then they two of the players ran across the linesman to give them the flags. And I remember before the game, the team lined up and they went to shake hands with every single one of their opponents. And I was thinking about that from a cultural perspective, players taking ownership, not waiting for the staff and coaches to do their jobs for them, if you like, but earn the right, you know, live as a family, take care of ourselves. We take care of the team. We take responsibility, if you like. And then the same day, I was watching the under-18s play against Bayer Leverkusen, which was a really important game for them. It was a league game. It was very close. It finished 1-1. But I was intrigued by the way that the coaches were behaving on the sidelines. And I remember seeing the Bayer Leverkusen coach charge up and down the touchline, like literally military style, shouting at the players. You know, he had a clipboard under his arm. I think he might have even had a whistle around his neck. You know, it was like 1980s gym coach, like going crazy at the players. And you could see the German players, they were like trying to play the game, but they were looking across to the coach at the same time. They were trying to play the game, but they were sort of, you know, the coach was significantly, you know, he was harming the players. He was damaging the performances. The Barca coach, and this is a game that was so close, by the way, Jack. The Barca coaches, in the shade of the dugout, every time the players did something well, they sort of stood up and gave them a clap. And every time they did something wrong, they might have stood up and whistled and then pointed a little bit, but then sat down. And for the majority of the game, they let the players perform, you know, make mistakes. And the game finished 1-1. And afterwards, with my translator, I was asking, you know, to the under-18s coaches, surely if you'd have given them more information in this game, then they must have been able to perform better. You might have been able to win, even, if you'd have helped them more. You know, whilst the game's going on. And I'll never forget the Barcelona coach looking back at me as if I was some crazy, crazy guy from England, right? And he's like, he looks back at the translator and he says to him, yes, the players are going to make more mistakes. And that's the point. That's the purpose. I'm giving them the platform. How would I ever know how much they've learned during the week unless I give them the space and time to make decisions independently of me? And I remember, Jack, I was thinking, ping, there's a light bulb goes off moment, you know, for me then. And because Monday to Friday, that's the coaching time. That's the time for the coach to work with the players, to impart knowledge, to set the game plan, to work with the individual different, you know, individual plans. Game day is their space and time, because when they eventually get, if we start from the end and work backwards at the Nou Camp with 90,000 watching, if you think that the first team players are going to hear every single word that the manager says, you're deluded. They're not going to hear a single word. They have to be able to perform in the absence of the constant intervention from the coach. So that stands out as a really powerful, you know, learning experience for me as a young coach.
No, ideal. Thank you for the insight. And it was about the culture and environment that I was aiming for rather than the practice. So, no, thank you so much for sharing. Cheers, yes. Incredible again.
No, thank you for your questions, Jack. Tom, we've got Kat up next. Kat, if you just introduce yourself, let us know your question, please.
Yeah, thank you. So this is Kat. I'm from the United States. So my question, to kind of follow up on that, is about vulnerability. And I know here in the culture that I'm in, if you show that you're vulnerable, whether as a player or as a coach, it's seen as a weakness. So I know I'm personally working on that, but how do you encourage other coaches or players themselves that like it's okay to be vulnerable and how to pull that vulnerability out of them, letting them know that it's okay to make mistakes and it's okay to show that vulnerability because that's how you grow. Kat, can you hear me?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
Hi. Hey.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, isn't it? It's a wonderful question. And also, Kat, it's a great reminder for all of us that the greatest strength comes from being able to be vulnerable. The greatest strength actually comes from sharing our vulnerabilities openly. And yet there is something about the ego, the world of not just professional football or football, that fuels that, is fueled by insecurity. We, you know, I can't admit that I don't know everything because then I might not be seen as, you know, the maestro, the conductor of the orchestra. But in actual fact, there's something great that happens when we share the vulnerabilities, when we ask the questions of the players. You know, guys, I don't know exactly what happened. I've got an idea, but can you help me? You know, Yas said earlier, to ask the questions of the players, what did you see? How were you feeling? What were you aware of? The reason those are great questions is because, number one, it gives the player the platform to discuss and explore and approach. But number two, it's sending a secondary message, which is, I don't know everything there is to know about the situation. And so therefore, in order for us to succeed, we is bigger than me. I need you guys and you need me. And together, when we're open and honest and authentically vulnerable, we have the ability to help our team to transcend. And when we talk about this living, breathing organism, you know, of the team, giving a voice to each player can be one of the single biggest empowering. You know, there was a coach at West Brom. I'll quickly tell this story. A guy called Jimmy Shan, under-18s coach. He's now a manager. And I remember a team talk that he gave at halftime. We were losing 2-0 to a team that we really should have been beating. And he said to three of the players, one of the captains, it was the under-18s youth team, before we went into the dressing room, he said, boys, I'm going to step back from the team talk because I think that you're seeing what's going on a lot better than I am. So I need 3 points at halftime. I'm going to give you the space. I'll step back as the coach, and if you need me, I'm here. Halftime came. The players delivered the team talk. Other players chipped in. The tension was completely removed. They came up with three brilliant pieces of strategy as an action plan for the second half. And, you know, we can all do this as coaches. This is not a secret. This doesn't cost lots of money. This isn't some, it's not an app that you have to download that's going to cost you, you know, thousands of dollars or pounds. It's a very simple skill. So, Kat, when you're talking about being vulnerable, it really is one of the greatest skills or services, you could say, that we can provide as a coach. Magic happens when we're authentically vulnerable and give the players a voice and space to share back.
I just want to kind of add to that, Tom. You know, you have some great points there, and two of them really resonate with me. First of all, is that vulnerability piece. I find that for myself, when I'm working with my players, being vulnerable, even to the point where I actually openly say, do you know what? I want to know what you see so that we can work together. And, you know, even if it comes to me putting on a new practice, guys, I've never tried this practice before. This might completely go left, but I'm hoping it does go right. And, you know, with your help, we're going to make it right if it's not. And I think that vulnerability, it transcends and transforms the way they see you. Rather than being a leader that's taking them on a journey, you're almost that leader that's on the journey with them. And I think that does massive things for their psyche and the way they look at you and maybe have a trust within you. And, you know, the second part, just on the team talk element, something that I tend to do with a lot of the teams and I've worked with in the past is actually I'll make a few points around what I wanted maybe potentially touch on in the halftime team talk, even post game or even pre game. But what I often do, and it kind of is in alignment with what you've just said there a bit, Tom, is split them up into their units potentially and ask them to come up with some ideas or points or observations that they've made, both in possession, out of possession, maybe as a unit of defenders, as a unit of midfielders, and maybe the forward unit, and obviously the goalkeeper attached to the defenders potentially, just to kind of see, right, here's my list as an example. I might have 3 or 4 points on my list that I want to touch on. Now, the reality is, if they can pick up on the same points that I'm wanting to cover, I don't really need to say anything. It's almost like, well done. You know, I'm glad you've observed that. Now they've observed it. Now come up with an action point or a plan of action beyond it. But I don't actually need to raise the point of, right, this is what I've seen, because they've already seen. I don't need to kind of drum in that information and potentially waste any time. And speaking of time, I'm very conscious of it. So Kat, thank you for your question. Guys, just a final reminder, you are listening to the Coaches Network podcast. Tom, I think we've got one more question if you've got time to take it. Very tight, I know.
I've got 60 seconds, so right. Go on the next meeting.
Go on, let's see if we can get him one and get this one done. Dan, yes, you're up.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, yes. Thank you for having me up. I appreciate you. Thank you, Mr. Vates. I appreciate you as well. Hope you're well.
Hi, Dan. Thank you. Yeah, great to see you. Speak to you.
Good. So, I think you may have mentioned it. I may have missed it. Can you just... my question basically is, what are the key principles of reaching peak performance?
This is the question that I said in another 3 hours. I'll try to sum it up. That is a great question. Okay, I'm going to try to sum it up. So first of all, we talked about... That's okay, no problem at all. Okay, peak performance, what is it? Peak performance, for me, the idea of peak performance is unleashing your full inner potential, whatever level that is. Before, I would have defined that as performing at the highest level. But the highest level for each of us is different, right? So it's this idea of unleashing the inner potential within us, whatever level that is at, whether that's Champions League or whether that's playing at the grassroots level, the best that I'm capable of giving within myself. And I spoke with Yas earlier, and we were talking about self-awareness being the key, one of the keys, to unlock peak performance. Asking, why is it that I do what I do? Yeah, what do I really want? And what do I need to do to be better at what it is that I do? All right, the key one about that is spending the time to ask ourselves the question, what is it that I really want? Why do I want it? And what do I need to do to be better at it? And so there are many, many other principles of peak performance, but starting with self, asking those questions of ourselves as coaches and as players, to give ourselves the opportunity to unleash that full inner potential. That's the best I can do with 60 seconds, Dan.
Right. And Tom's already committed to elaborating that on a part two. That's in a right, Tom.
Very good. I'd love to.
Nice one, Tom. Thank you, Coach.
Right. Guys, again, just a quick reminder, you have been tuned into the Coaches Network live edition with Tom Bates, UEFA A licensed coach, performance psychologist, speaker, and author of the book, The Future Coach. And on that note, this episode will be released in a few weeks on the social platforms. And there will be a giveaway for Tom's book on there. But Tom, just before we kind of head off, would you mind just letting the listeners know where they can get in touch with you should they have any questions or wanted to know more about what we've discussed, and maybe keep an eye out for that giveaway when it does come up?
Sure. Awesome. Yes. Thanks very much for your time. I've loved the question, loved this thinking space together. I'm on all the socials. Tom at TomBatesCoaching.com. is my website, TomBatesCoaching.com. You can find the book, The Future Coach, Coaching Tomorrow Soccer Players Today on Amazon. You can also reach out through the website to get a copy of that. And the free signed copy will be released for any coaches who will be tuning in. Yas has got a special secret strategy to select the well-deserved recipient of that book. So that will be released soon. But from me, yes, thanks very much to you as well for providing this space on behalf of not just myself, but all the coaches that tune in from around the world. It's a fantastic initiative, and I want to take this time to wish you every success on your coaching journey as well.
Likewise, Tom, thank you again for your time this evening. Guys, feel free to kind of just ping myself and Tom, pop on our profiles, follow us, hit that bell so you know when any future conversations are taking place. Use the hashtag The Coaches Network Podcast. And thank you for being part of the conversation tonight, guys. I will be ending the room. But until next time, guys, take care.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.